The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Good evening, and welcome to The Business of Giving. I'm your host, Denver Frederick, and tonight we're going to discuss a program that successfully addresses unplanned pregnancies and an exceptional educational organization for children from low-income communities. We'll begin with Mark Edwards, the co-CEO of Upstream USA. Did you know that nearly half the pregnancies in the U.S. are unplanned and often with negative consequences for both the mother and child? What Upstream helps to do is provide women with more contraceptive options and with better ones.
What the data show is in a typical year, nearly 10% of pill users become pregnant. So, and that's mostly because of compliance issues. But what's exciting is that there are new methods of birth control that are in clinical trials 20 times more effective than the pill. These are the new long-acting reversible contraceptive methods, the new IUDs and implants.
And then you're going to hear from Richard Berlin, the executive director of DREAM, formerly Harlem RBI. He describes the role they play in poor communities like East Harlem and the South Bronx this way.
Over the last 20 or 30 years, I think it's come to organizations like DREAM to fill that gap and to do so really intentionally and to really upend a model of support which is broken and replace it with something that provides lots of opportunity, lots of support, but really high expectations for kids and families about what they can achieve.
And for our Better Than Most Corporate Culture segment, you'll be going to Washington, D.C. to visit the offices of the Peace Corps. But first, the Business of Giving News Digest for Sunday, April 8th. A group of foundations, businesses, and individual donors has announced the launch of the Audacious Project, collaborative philanthropy for bold ideas. To be housed at TED, a nonprofit devoted to ideas worth spreading, the $250 million initiative will fund as many as 5 ideas a year that stand out as bold and are supported by a viable and sustainable plan for implementation, scaling, and impact. Funding for human rights increased by almost 50% during the first half of this decade, according to a new study. Donors are a big source of sexual harassment that fundraisers face on the job, according to polling results released this week by the Chronicle of Philanthropy and the Association of Fundraising Professionals. 2/3 of the people who reported sexual harassment on the job blamed donors, while the rest said misconduct came from colleagues, mostly those in senior positions. In the days and weeks following the February 14th shooting in Parkland, Florida, the National Rifle Association saw a significant spike in donations. In fact, reports from the Federal Election Commission show donations to the NRA's Political Victory Fund tripled from January to February. McKesson, one of the nation's largest drug distributors and the target of multiple lawsuits related to the opioid epidemic, pledged $100 million to create a new foundation that will combat drug abuse and addiction. And finally, you can donate to charity with your voice by asking Amazon's Alexa. The tech giant announced a new feature called Alexa Donations, powered by Amazon Pay. Now you can just say, Alexa, donate $10 to the American Cancer Society or any supported charity of your choice. Or you can say, Alexa, make a donation, and Alexa will ask you to pick a charity and a dollar amount. And that is a Business of Giving News Digest for this Sunday evening. I'll be back with Mark Edwards of Upstream USA right after this.
Top companies have now begun to discover a reliable source for skilled new talent, and they're finding great success with employees who are productive, engaged, and innovative. Explore the country's largest untapped talent pool, 24 million Americans with disabilities. The National Organization on Disability is the leading partner for companies looking to accelerate their disability employment efforts, attract, hire, and retain. Learn more at nod.org. Do you remember your first job? We all deserve opportunity, but the frustrating truth is that while talent is equally distributed in the U.S., opportunity is not. 6 million talented young adults in the U.S. are out of work and out of school. Year Up empowers these young adults with valuable skills and connects them to leading U.S. companies. The results are real. 85% of Year Up alums are employed or in school within 4 months of graduating. Support opportunity for all young adults. Visit yearup.org. Follow the Business of Giving on Twitter at BizOfGive and at Facebook.com/BusinessOfGiving. And now, back to the Business of Giving with your host, Denver Frederick, on AM 970, The Answer.
An unplanned pregnancy can really disrupt a young woman's life. It can have negative health effects for both her and her baby. It can lead to her dropping out of school. And the college completion rates among young mothers is quite low. But there is an organization that is tackling this problem head on with remarkable success. It's Upstream USA. And with us tonight is their co-founder and CEO, Mark Edwards. Good evening, Mark, and welcome to the Business of Giving.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You know, before we get into the particulars of what you do and how you do it, let's first discuss the topic of unplanned pregnancy in the U.S. Give us a sense of the dimensions of this issue.
Well, the dimensions are really significant here in the U.S. So in a typical year in the U.S., nearly half of all pregnancies are actually unplanned pregnancies. These data come from women themselves describing their own pregnancies. But what's surprising to most people is that a significant percentage of these pregnancies occur to women who are actually using birth control. In other words, they know this is not a time they want to have a child, but the method of birth control they're using fails them. And we see, you know, much higher rates among poor and low-income women, in large part because the places that poor and low-income women get their health care make it very difficult to get access to the most effective methods of birth control, which are the new IUDs and implants.
I touched upon this a little bit in the opening, but what are the negative impacts, both health and otherwise, for both the woman and child that are connected with these unplanned pregnancies?
Well, when women have pregnancies before they plan them or want them, there are a whole set of downstream effects that are negative. So one, health outcomes are poorer because, of course, if you aren't planned to become pregnant, then you may not do all the prenatal care you would otherwise. You see higher incidences of things like fetal alcohol syndrome. And of course, there are a whole set of other downstream outcomes beyond the pregnancy themselves, which are negative. Having a child before you plan for it is challenging enough having children when you're planning for
them.
And so the important thing here is we're really trying to help women achieve their own goals of becoming pregnant only when they want to.
Yeah, I'm going to pick up on what you said a moment ago. Birth control pills are the most popular contraceptive among U.S. women. Condoms are slightly behind.
Yep.
Are they not that effective?
They aren't that effective. Those methods of birth control are very effective if you are very good at taking them. But the truth is that many women are not. So what the data show is in a typical year, nearly 10% of pill users become pregnant. And that's mostly because of compliance issues. But what's exciting is that there are new methods of birth control that are in clinical trials 20 times more effective than the pill. These are the new long-acting reversible contraceptive methods, the new IUDs and implants. These are the methods of birth control that OBGYNs use themselves for their own birth control. You won't find an OBGYN who uses the pill because she understands that these are much more effective methods of birth control. Lower doses of hormones, you don't have to think about it every day. You return to fertility faster with these methods compared to the pill. So these are just modern methods of birth control. But the places that particularly poor and low-income women get their health care make it very difficult for them to get access to these methods. And the interesting thing is it's not because of cost issues. It's mostly because of a set of administrative and systems barriers in health centers, which means they can't get those methods in one visit. It'll take them 3 or 4 visits. And women don't have time to make 3 or 4 visits to the doctor to get birth control.
Yeah, that's for sure. Let's talk a little bit more about these LARCs, as they're referred to, long-acting reversible contraceptions, IUD and hormonal patches. How long do they last?
So, you know, there are several methods of IUDs, and there's one method of the implant. Among the IUDs, they last anywhere from 5 to 10 years. But again, these are completely reversible.
Yeah.
So when you take them out, you can become pregnant right away.
Absolutely.
The implant called Nexplanon lasts for 3 years. There are hormonal IUDs. There are non-hormonal IUDs. There's a whole selection there.
What do they cost compared to, let's say, a pack of birth control pills?
So for most women in this country, these methods are free. So let's just start with that. They are free. And that's, of course, the tragedy here is that most women are actually not even offered these methods. And so even though the barriers are not cost barriers. And so, you know, I think in any other form of medicine, if you imagine, imagine a stent that was 20 times more effective than another stent.
Yeah.
And when you went to the doctor, they didn't even offer you that stent. They said, mm-hmm. we'll just give you this one instead. That's what's happening with birth control. And so our goal is to make sure that women can get access to all methods of birth control, and then they can choose which methods are best for them.
That seems to make a lot of sense. What are the challenges, then, at these health centers, where these women go? Why are they not offered this option as it stands right now?
So there are a number of challenges. I wish there was just one or two, but there are a number of them.
Yeah.
So it starts with the fact that for example, not enough providers are trained to place these methods.
Hmm.
So literally, they don't have the skills to do that. And that's part of the work that we do, is to make sure that providers are trained so they can place and remove these methods. In addition, you know, health centers often won't stock the methods. So by definition, it requires multiple visits. You have to come in, they get ordered, they have to come back. Women don't come back. Health centers don't know how to bill and code properly. And so when that happens, they don't feel like they get properly reimbursed, which means there's a disincentive to offer these methods. So that, you know, for example, they don't have a proper workflow so that women can actually get them in one visit. There are a bunch of those kinds of administrative and systems barriers that get in the way. And that's really the work that we do, is remove those barriers.
Well, let's get into the work that you do, and I don't think there's a better place to start than Delaware. Upstream has spent a lot of time, a lot of energy, and a lot of resources in Delaware. Let me start with this, Mark. Why Delaware?
Well, we learned early on that Delaware has one of the highest unplanned pregnancy rates in the country.
No kidding.
Yes, which was, I think, a surprise to lots of people. You know, it is bundled along with a whole set of other states, and those other states are ones that you would probably imagine, mostly in the South. But Delaware has a very high rate of unplanned pregnancy. The governor at the time, Governor Jack Markell, a very entrepreneurial governor.
On your board now, right?
Now on our board, exactly. We went to him and said, look, Delaware has one of the highest rates of unplanned pregnancy. He believed that unplanned pregnancy is associated with a whole set of other downstream costs that the state was in many ways shouldering. And we said, look, if we can reduce unplanned pregnancy, that'll have a number of positive outcomes for Delaware. He got very excited about it, asked us to develop a statewide plan. And so for the last couple of years, that's been our work, is literally transforming the healthcare system in Delaware so that all women can get access to all methods of birth control with great counseling in a single visit.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned training and technical assistance, you know, to these Title X health centers and some of the big hospitals and the private providers. What exactly do you do?
So there are sort of three sort of core things that are important about our work. The first is we're trying to bring reproductive health care into the center of primary care. If you're a woman of reproductive age, unplanned pregnancies are sort of a part of your life. And so our goal is to make sure that in a typical primary care visit, not a specialty care, but a primary care visit, you're asked, for example, a very simple question. Do you want to get pregnant in the next year? As a standard question. And so in Delaware today, that is the state of play. No matter why you enter into a health system for anything at all, you'll be asked, do you want to become pregnant the next year?
And that can lead to a conversation, I bet.
Absolutely. And so what happens is that if the answer is yes, I do, then fantastic. Let's make sure you have a nice, healthy baby and do the preconception care. But if the answer is no, in that visit, you should be able to leave with any method of birth control that you want. That's very important. I can't tell you how often we'll talk to women who were in a health center for some other unrelated reason in January. It could be for diabetes, depression, whatever she's there for, and then back in June with a high-risk unplanned pregnancy. And you say to yourself, she was right in that health center. Why didn't we talk about it? And
yeah.
The reason is that reproductive health care is often not at the center of primary care. So that has really changed dramatically. So that's the first thing that we do. But the second thing, of course, is that when women say, no, I don't want to become pregnant, they should be able to leave that visit, not come back, but leave that visit with any method of birth control, including one of these long-acting reversible methods. And so, as you can imagine, that requires a whole set of sort of training, technical assistance, systems work to make sure that even though she came in for diabetes, she wants to leave with a method of birth control. And so that work at the health center itself of getting those workflows in place, billing and coding, stocking the methods, proper counseling, that's at the core of the work. And then finally, the third major part of our work is we run large-scale consumer marketing campaigns so that women know about this.
Yeah,
they know
education.
They can get these methods. Exactly, education campaigns.
Yeah. And when LARCs are made available to women, what percentage of them choose that method?
Well, you know, we're just learning this now. But what we know is that many more women choose these methods, and we also know they're much happier with these methods than with birth control pills. There's lots of data about that. So we're already seeing in Delaware, even though we've only been working there for 3 years, significantly more women choosing these methods. They're happier with these methods. We also have very good data that show that women are actually in charge of making their own choices about birth control. This is really important to us. The goal is that women really should be able to choose whatever method works for them with great counseling. And we have, you know, good evidence that shows that upwards of 99% of women are saying, I was in charge of choosing my method of birth control. This is the decision that I made by me.
Well, you've been in Delaware, as you say, for a few years. What has been the impact? What are the results?
So it's very exciting. It's really been just about three and a half years. And we've seen a number of results, both at the health center level. In other words, literally a higher percentage of women are choosing these more effective methods. What we're also seeing, though, is a higher percentage of women overall just on birth control. Because now this question, do you want to become pregnant in the next year, is a standard screening question, more women are just on more birth control of, all kinds. And that has a huge impact on reducing unplanned pregnancy. One thing I should say, it's important, is that people often think that unplanned pregnancy is all about teens. It's not. So teen pregnancy, it represents about 15% of overall unplanned pregnancy. The bulk of unplanned pregnancy is actually single women in their 20s.
Yeah.
That's where you really see it. And so teen pregnancy is important. I think we're making good progress in this country about teen pregnancy, even though, of course, the rates are still higher than every place else. But we've made good progress.
It was a great campaign by MTV a couple of years ago around
that. Yes, it was. And I think it demonstrated to have some real impact. But again, those numbers are still higher than they should be.
Yep.
But the bulk of unplanned pregnancy is actually single women in their 20s. And we're beginning to see those rates come down already. And just recently, a group out of Washington, Child Trends, released a report showing that among women in Delaware on Title 10, Title 10 really represents some of the most vulnerable women in Delaware. We've already seen in just 2 years a drop of 15% in unplanned pregnancy in Delaware, which is really very exciting.
Congratulations. That is truly significant. You know, another early success story was in Colorado. Tell us what happened there.
Well, we were, of course, we're not involved with the Colorado
project,
but it was very inspirational for us and was one of the reasons that we started Upstream. Colorado demonstrated that by making these methods available to women throughout the state, they were able to reduce the teen pregnancy by close to 50% over about 8 or 9 years. Better birth outcomes, significantly reduced costs to the state. So a real important demonstration project.
Well, one that you are involved in is right here in New York City, and that's a partnership you have with an organization called DOOR. Tell us about that intervention and the results that it has yielded.
So the DOOR is a fabulous partner of ours. They are a multi-service site for adolescents here in the city, downtown. And they have a whole set of programs for adolescents, ranging everything from sort of health care to sort of classes to job training, the whole bit. But unfortunately, in their health center there, they were not set up to be able to offer the most effective methods of birth control. They were basically offering pills. And predictably, I think they had relatively high rates of unplanned pregnancy, as they do throughout the country. We were able to work closely with the medical director there and their whole medical team so that now patients at the DOOR can really get all methods of birth control, including these long-acting reversible methods. We've seen the numbers of women choosing these methods go up significantly. And what's exciting is that even though our sort of formal partnership really has ended with the DOOR, it's sort of a one-time intervention, we've seen they've continued to be able to offer these methods on an ongoing basis. So the cumulative impact of this has really been quite significant.
You know, there's a lack of evidence around so many programs. You're one that really does have hard data and results. So the next question would be government support for these kinds of programs, which has to happen at the state level. Are they providing the necessary funding to be able to scale these programs?
Well, what's unusual about the work that we're doing is that we're operating in a sort of a policy environment that's actually pretty positive. So most states in this country have policies that mean that women insured women in the state, whether insured privately or insured with Medicaid, can get these methods for free. That's just the standard of care here in the U.S. The challenge is that the actual practice, though, in health centers is not that way. In practice, it means you can get the pill right now, but it may take you 3 or 4 visits to get one of these more effective methods, and women don't have time to make those visits.
They don't come back.
Exactly. And so, you know, our goal, we're not an advocacy organization. We're not trying to change laws. We're operating in places where the laws and the policy environment is actually really supportive. It's really about changing healthcare practice to make sort of the spirit of those laws sort of available. But you're right. The work we do, of course, is training and technical assistance, and that work is not really supported by governments. So they often will pay for the actual birth control themselves as part of your insurance, but they're not paying for this critical training work to make sure that it actually is made available. So that's the place where we really need support.
Yeah. Well, you got some of it from an organization called Blue Meridian Partners. They have invested a significant amount, $60 million in the work that you do, and that's an incredible testimonial, Mark, for a young organization like yours to breed that level of confidence. Tell us about that partnership and what it will mean for the organization and for the women that you serve.
Upstream feels incredibly fortunate to have a partnership with Blue Meridian Partners. They are a funder collaborative that has raised about $1 billion to make large-scale sort of 10 to 15-year investments in a small number of nonprofits that they think can really make a big difference in expanding opportunity for young adults. And they've made a significant investment in Upstream to really help us scale. And on the back of that, we are really in the process of raising even additional resources to bring the work we've done in Delaware to three other states in this first chapter of work. And so, you know, as you can imagine, you know, the scale of this work is significant. So in a typical year in the U.S., there are about 1.5 million unplanned children born. So if you think about the math, I mean, these are big dollars. And states around the country, without exception, spend, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars just on healthcare-related costs for unplanned pregnancies. And so we're really trying to tackle a problem which is really quite significant. And so as extraordinary as that level of support is, we're actually, we have to raise more money to be able to do this at scale.
Yeah, I'm sure you do. You know, just give us a story or two in terms of the impact that this has on the women that you serve. I just can't even imagine how the trajectory of their lives have changed. I mean, what have you seen having done this work now for 4 or 5 years?
One of the most extraordinary inspirational stories I heard was from an OBGYN in Denver, actually, who told me about a patient that she had. This was actually a 40-year-old mother, mother of two, married, sort of a high-powered lawyer. And this patient told her OBGYN that when she was 15, for some reason, her pediatrician was able to give her, 16, excuse me, she was able to get access to one of these long-acting reversible contraceptive methods.
Mm-hmm.
And this patient says it really made all the difference for her because she had nine female cousins in Denver, none of whom had access to effective birth control, all of whom got pregnant and had children before the age of 18, all of whom ended up on welfare. She went on to become a very successful lawyer and really credits access to effective birth control as being sort of her ticket to be able to achieve the goals that she had for herself. We see stories like this on a daily basis. Having a child before you plan for it or want it is a very challenging situation. And so our entire goal is to really try to create an environment where women can decide for themselves when and if they become pregnant.
Yeah, I can't think of a better way to alter this intergenerational cycle of poverty, because this is particularly in low-income communities, right?
So it is concentrated in low-income communities. Though if you understand the fact that nearly half of all pregnancies in the U.S. are unplanned, this actually happens really across mm-hmm. the spectrum. It can have, obviously, some more challenging outcomes for low-income women. You know, the whole conversation about opportunity in this country starts when kids are born. Mm-hmm. We say, this child is here. What do we do now to make sure this child can achieve its full potential? You know, our view is that helping women achieve their own goals of becoming pregnant only when they want to really is at the center of the opportunity conversation, and we need to include that in this dialogue.
Let me close with this, Mark, and let's get back to scaling. Boy, Blue Meridian has been a wind at your back, $60 million, hopefully 1.5 million women, 4 states. But you got to do a lot more than that to make this available to all women across the country. What are the challenges and what are the things that need to happen to make these choices accessible to all women?
Well, I think first and foremost, we need to shift the dialogue about opportunity in this country so that we understand that pregnancy planning and prevention should be at the center of this. Again, I'm not talking about abortion here. I'm talking about making sure that women get access to effective birth control so they can decide when and if they become pregnant.
That's a big distinction, too, because I'm sure a lot of people kind of conflate the two.
They do. They do. We're really talking about, of course, most abortion happens because people have unplanned pregnancies.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can actually help women prevent those, that's a critical distinction. Second is I think we need to ensure that all women have access to the full range of birth control methods. So in many states, insured women have the access, but many uninsured women do not.
Yeah.
And so it's really important, I think. It makes so much sense from a cost perspective as well. Of course, helping women, you know, prevent pregnancies they don't want is really much more cost effective than dealing with the issue once we have a child that's an unplanned child. So that's an important distinction as well. And finally, I think, you know, what's really important to remember is that this is simply best-in-class healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
So these methods of birth control are considered by the CDC, by the American College of OBGYNs, most recently by the American Academy of Pediatrics, as being best-in-class healthcare, best-in-class birth control for all women, all adolescents, period. So this is just simply modern birth control. And we've got to there's no reason this should be sort of more politicized. These are really methods that women prefer when they get access to them, and it has a huge impact.
Yeah, no reason is absolutely right. I mean, there's a lot of problems in this country. We can solve many of them, but this is one that we can with the right will. Mark Edwards, the Chief Executive Officer of Upstream USA, I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. If listeners should be interested in learning more about the organization, tell us a little bit about your website and the kind of information that you have there.
Well, Upstream is at upstream.org.
Mm-hmm.
There you'll find both sort of case studies about the work we're doing, the kinds of training and technical assistance we're doing, a lot of work, information about our work in Delaware, and of course, information about how to donate as well.
Absolutely. Thanks, Mark. It was a great pleasure to have you on the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'll be back with more of The Business of Giving right after this.
You probably know Sesame Street as the TV show that taught you letters and numbers. But Sesame is so much more. Sesame Workshop is a nonprofit with a mission to help all children grow smarter, stronger, and kinder. Big Bird wants to help, so he started the Yellow Feather Fund to bring education to children in need. You can help too. Visit yellowfeatherfund.org to learn more or make a donation. That's yellowfeatherfund.org. Follow The Business of Giving on Twitter at BizOfGive and at Facebook.com/BusinessOfGiving. And now, back to The Business of Giving with your host, Denver Frederick, on AM 970, The Answer.
In 1991, Dream, then known as Harlem RBI, was founded by a group of volunteers that transformed a neglected, garbage-strewn lot into two baseball diamonds in East Harlem. It took off from there. First with after-school and summer programs, and then with the Dream Charter School to become one of the most highly regarded programs for underserved youth in the nation. And here with us tonight to discuss how they did it is Richard Berlin, the executive director of Dream. Good evening, Rich, and welcome to The Business of Giving.
Good evening, Denver. Thanks for having me here.
You know, it's been a fascinating journey over these past 27 years, and you've been on board for most of the trip. Give us a brief history of how this organization evolved from those two baseball diamonds to Harlem RBI and now Dream.
Yeah, it's been it's hardly been a linear path, but one that has been mostly upward and always guided toward impact. The organization, as you said, started when a group of volunteers took an abandoned block on what was then one of the worst blocks in New York City. It was actually on the cover of the New York Times under a banner headline, Worst Block in New York City. So straight from Central Casting. And East 100th Street and East Harlem at the time really was a model of generational poverty. And I think the idea, while there may have been a lot of highfalutin pretensions about what this thing could be, at the beginning it was 75 teenage boys playing baseball, and an alternative to gang violence, an alternative to the streets, a safe place for kids to play, which most of us take for granted. But if you lived on that block, you were actually afraid to let your kid out during the day, let alone at night. It was such an unsafe place. And the minute kids were out, not surprisingly, not only were they having fun, but doing something productive, mm-hmm. and you started building a little bit of community. And alongside all this positive, everybody quickly saw all the gaps and negatives, too, that it was great that we had kids a few hours a week or even more than that during the summer, but kids would sort of come and go, and even the children, and maybe the children even who were most engaged, were the ones who would sort of fade away and you couldn't keep connected to, because really what you were running was a seasonal recreation program. And that led us to think about what we were doing and why we were there, and started to think a little bit more intentionally both how we grew our business, but most importantly how we grew our mission, and led to what I call a desire to scale our program, not outward, but to scale in, mm-hmm. to go deeper into our community, first with summer learning and then with after school, ultimately with the charter school, and now into multiple communities, but always looking at a set of impacts which could help get kids out of the cycle of poverty into which they are born and help transform the fabric of their communities, which didn't always provide enough support and opportunity for them to thrive.
Let's talk about those communities a little bit. In New York City, as you said, you work or you serve in East Harlem and the South Bronx, two of the most under-resourced communities in the city. Give us an idea of the challenges that those communities face.
You know, I think at root, in poor communities, urban or rural, but particularly urban communities like East Harlem and Mott Haven in the South Bronx where we work, what you see is a failure of the institutions that almost all families rely on to navigate their daily life. So whether it's public hospitals or public schools, all these versions of the public sort of failing families, public housing very much in the news these days. Mm-hmm. And right, these are families who are already very much on the edge of really dire poverty, often in violent neighborhoods and challenging places. So, you know, when you take people with limited resources and then you put them in places that are broken or failing, the idea that people will somehow pull themselves up by the bootstraps is really, you know, a fallacious notion which most people in the country have left behind. And over the last 20 or 30 years, I think it's come to organizations like Dream to fill that gap and to do so really intentionally and to really upend a model of support which is broken, mm-hmm. And replace it with something that provides lots of opportunity, lots of support, but really high expectations for kids and families about what they can achieve.
You know, with your operations in New York City, and I know you're also over in Newark now, how many boys and girls do you serve in any given year?
Yep. Dream is now serving a little bit over 2,200 young children
Wow.
from pre-K through college, always with the goal of making sure they're academically successful, ready for work and life beyond Dream, whatever their engagement may be, and also with a desire and willingness to come back and return to the fold and give back to the communities that help raise them. You know, they're waiting lists for almost everything that we do, but our view has always been, let's do really high quality work that transforms kids' lives, doesn't just water the leaves, so to speak, but gets at the roots.
Yeah.
And if we do that well, we'll grow plenty over time. And if we never added another kid, the responsibility for serving 2,200 families is hardly inconsequential.
Well, doing it well is somewhat dependent upon your theory of change, which is informed in part by the Maslow hierarchy of needs. And I think it's best exemplified, Rich, for those four core elements of your program. I'm going to ask you to walk us through those, if you would. The first is to provide a safe and inspiring place. Now, I've been up to your place, and it is a wonderful, wonderful facility. How do you think about it? How do you think about space? How do you think about facility?
So if we go to our founding metaphor, which is baseball,
mm-hmm.
right, the most important thing you gotta be in baseball is safe at home.
Right.
And I think this idea that children can learn and grow and thrive in places that aren't comfortable for them is really, really dangerous. You go into typical public school, they feel more like a jail or a bomb shelter or something really institutional. The first thing you see when you walk into a public school is usually a police officer, a public safety officer, which hardly gives you the idea that you're probably, you know, in an unthreatening place. So our view is twofold. One is that love surrounds these kids all the time, whether it's their families or teachers or mentors or coaches. But the second is that everywhere you go is inspiring and elevating in itself. It's why our baseball field looks like a mini Yankee stadium. It's why our school looks like an institution of higher learning, not simply a grade school, because these are the places we expect our kids to go when they grow up. But this is also what it takes. There's a reason places look like this in affluent communities, because that is the expectation and model of success. That is the type of environment people want to be in. That is the type of environment people come together to create health and safety and opportunity for kids.
Your second core element is collaboration with community and family. What are some of the elements there?
So Dream, formerly Harlem RBI, is also built around a concept we call the power of teams. We think you can almost separate the world between people who grew up playing on a team and those who didn't. and we really believe that we just believe deeply that the idea that we're here to fix something is really mistaken, right? We are collaborators. We are partners. We are part of the fabric of neighborhoods. And you know, this isn't a place where a parent sends their child and, you know, we inject them with some dosage of something and magically they return to them and healthy and happy. Like a kid is a kid 24 hours a day. No matter how much time with their kids, they'll always spend more time with their families, as they should. So families, extended and immediate, really need to be part of this work. And so close collaboration and understanding of our mission, the ability to have healthy disagreements about what's best for a kid,
mm-hmm.
but fundamentally our belief that every parent is their child's best advocate. Nobody knows a kid better than a parent, and nobody wants a kid to succeed more than that parent. Now, they may not always have all the tools they need, and that's where we come to work, but we've got to do that work together. And that starts with having a place where families want to be, and that starts with always having parents and families part of the dialogue of our work, so that when there is a tough conversation to be had, it's easy because there's trust. And you know, for every 10 times we call a family, hopefully only one of them is for something where your kid fell off the tracks. And
yeah.
And you know, but you know, typical typical East Harlem family, when an institution in their life calls, it's probably not for a good reason.
Not good news.
We try to upend that model.
Mm-hmm. Third, you place a tremendous value on developmental relationships. Explain that.
Yeah, so kids are different at different times of their life, and you've got to be thoughtful about what you're asking kids to do. But mostly at root, it's this, right? Baseball is a game of failure. If you succeed 3 out of 10 times, if you fail 7 out of 10 times,
All-Star team,
you're a Hall of Famer. Never mind All-Star team. And really, we think that is where growth happens in failure. Mm-hmm. Nobody learns anything from success. Right, the minute you've succeeded at something, you should be trying harder to do the next thing. That's sort of our organizational viewpoint. You're either growing or dying, and we want our kids to always be testing those boundaries too. We want it to be safe for them to fail, because in failure, you've got to imagine a different way of succeeding. We know we always have it in them. We want to be pushing them hard, supporting them a ton, and making failure a safe place, because that's where we believe learning and development happens.
And your fourth core element is that you provide developmental experiences. Now, give us an example of a few of those.
So we love that we educate kids in lots of formal ways. But at root, we actually think, right, the best type of learning happens when kids are teaching each other, or kids are exploring on their own. And most importantly, where learning relates to the real world, not a textbook or what's on your whiteboard or smart board, as the case may be now.
Mm-hmm.
So first and foremost, we think the best classroom we have is like a batting cage or a pitcher's mound. But when it's not that, you know, most recent and powerful one for me is that our entire 9th grade of our first high school class was in Washington, D.C. 2 weeks ago for the March for Life.
Oh, that's great.
And, you know, that was midterms week, and did we want to stretch and do that? And not only did we want to stretch and do that, the principal decided, well, can we get to D.C. a day early so they can go visit the Capitol and Chuck Schumer can host them, and we can get to the African American History Museum, mm-hmm. and maybe get a college visit in, because that is real life. That is what this is preparing them for. We're not preparing them to be in the next classroom. We are preparing them to be leaders and citizens, which this country so desperately needs. It is experiences like that which force you to relate your academic learning to real-world circumstances and make you an agent, an actor in the world, which we think helps transform how these kids see themselves and what they think they can do in the world.
Yeah. Active civics. Get it out of the classroom and get them out there on the streets. The Dream Charter School was established in 2008. I think it was just kindergarten and first grade.
That's right.
Initially, tell us how it's grown over this past decade.
So today, Dream is pre-K through 9. We've grown downward and upward, mm-hmm. and soon there will be a high school and probably be another K to 8 coming soon enough. And I have to say, it's probably been the hardest thing we've ever done, not just because school is hard, but because our idea of school is an extended day, extended year learning model. And really believing that 8, 9 to 4, or in our case, 8 to 4, simply won't do it if you want to hit all those ways of learning and living that we talk about in our theory of change. So integrating what we grew up with as an organization, out of school time and extended day learning, with a formal school curriculum has been an enormous challenge, but one that's paying off. Dream now outperforms the city, state, and district by substantial margins. But I think what we're most proud of is, alongside of that, Dream serves an extremely diverse population of students, a higher percentage of special ed and English language learners than our district, which has one of the highest populations of special ed students in the city. So this is a place that serves every child,
mm-hmm.
and expects excellence from every child.
You know, speak a little bit more about that impact, because you really do have some outstanding results, and I want you to share them with our audience. What has been the impact of these programs and the charter school compared to others in the district and the state and across the country?
Yeah, well, so the school itself outperforms district, state, and city by substantial margins on standardized testing. But, of course, a standardized test is a snapshot of a kid's life.
Mm-hmm.
It's not where they end up. So we really focus on high school graduation and now college graduation as well. So over the last 10 years, close to 99% of the kids who've come through our program have graduated high school and gone on to college. And in the last 5 or 6 years, we've really focused on college success as a metric or a measure proxy for how we're doing with our kids.
Mm-hmm.
When we started looking at high school graduation, less than 25% of our kids were on track to graduate in 6 years. It's only 60% nationally across a heterogeneous population.
Yeah.
Since that time, we've started investing in kids' college success with what we call our Legends program. Today, almost 70% of our kids are on track for a five-year graduation rate, and that number is steadily climbing every year. And then, of course, most importantly, we've got 13 of our legends or alums who are college graduates who work for the organization mm-hmm. and have earned their job. And when we think about a really virtuous cycle for our young people in our communities, it is those people becoming staff and volunteers and board members and donors and eventually taking my job, I hope, which makes us a truly sustainable place.
Fantastic. What's the process for selecting students who will be admitted to the Dream Charter School?
Yep. Charters are done by lottery mm-hmm. with a few preferences. In our case, the first preference, of course, goes to siblings of students who are in the school, so families don't get broken up. The second is 50% of every new seat, every new kindergarten or pre-K seat is set aside for students and families who live in public housing in East Harlem. That's a way of ensuring that we're always serving the most vulnerable populations. And a recent addition to change in state law, which we're starting to see reflected in our student population, is we have a 10% preference for children of staff.
Mm-hmm.
And we think it's particularly powerful way of retaining teachers who might have a hard time staying in the city because they can't find a great public school for their kids. And talk about a testimonial to what we're doing. Like, at the end of the day, forget all the metrics. Is Dream a place you would send your own child?
Yep.
And if the answer to that is no, then I think you got to reflect pretty hard on what you're really up to.
The ultimate net promoter question,
that's right.
For sure. Let's take a step back for a second, if we could. You know, there are so many myths and misunderstandings about charter schools. I mean, are they public schools? Are they not? How are they financed? What impact do they have on the public school system and the community? Provide us, if you would, with a sort of a charter school 101.
Yeah, charters are, I think we call charters political hot button issues, right?
Yeah, I think you might be right.
So charter schools are publicly funded, privately operated schools. In New York State, privately operated almost exclusively by private nonprofit organizations. Nationally, there are some for-profit operators who, for the most part, have been less successful at doing this than their nonprofit brethren. New York State has particularly strong charter laws, and politically, Mayors Bloomberg and Governor Cuomo have been particularly strong backers of this movement,
mm-hmm.
which, in fact, started as a teacher-led and family-led movement to replace failing public schools with community and teacher-led schools that were better serving their kids, or at least not the same old model of failure. In East Harlem and the South Bronx, where we work, public schools in those districts have been persistently failing for close to four decades mm-hmm. at this point in time. And by failing, I mean kids not only can't pass their standardized tests, but drop out of school at an alarming rate as they become teenagers.
Yeah.
So one of the transitions that's happened in the proliferation of charter schools is that politically, while they started largely as community-based reform efforts, they've now become supported by a much more diverse political spectrum of money and policy backers. And at root, the war to open new charters, which are typically non-unionized schools, is between teachers' unions and those who would like to see these schools grow. I think here's where we come down on it. There are lots of great public schools, and there are lots of great charter schools, and there are lots of versions of both that aren't necessarily doing all the things that you'd like a school to do. But I think what we can say about traditional public schools, particularly in poor communities, is that there is now a long and clear history of sort of intractable failure in these schools, and you can see it in lots of places. And I sort of point to facilities as kind of an interesting talisman in this, right? Almost every public school you see in low-income communities is a 30, 40, 50, 60-year-old building.
Mm-hmm.
Find me an industry that has not retooled in 50 or 60 years. You can't find one because they're all dead. Public education is not dead because our government rightfully continues to support it, but without changing of the model of how we work. And I think most importantly in that model to us is the idea that schools are run around the kids' needs. And I think too often public schools are tailored and organized around the adults' needs, mm-hmm. specifically in the case of public schools, around very thick collective bargaining agreements, which state how much, what days teachers can teach and how many hours teachers can teach. And education is not like that. Education, particularly in low-income communities, is a whatever-it-takes game.
Yeah.
Now, I think, you know, the vast majority of teachers are incredibly hardworking, talented, committed people. But structurally, if they work in systems which, A, limit the times and places and ways they can influence and create change, and, B, very clearly do protect low performers within their mm-hmm. midst, you create a system of dysfunction. Charters are intended to disrupt that dysfunction. But to me, it is, in fact, a public disruption. I mean, right, nobody complains about the fact that they're nonprofits running after-school programs. Like, everybody's okay with public dollars going to that. Why is everybody so up in arms about public dollars going to more formal education? Well, because there's no after-school workers union.
Mm-hmm.
There's a teachers union. It's very powerful. It does a lot of good things for teachers, as it should. But I think sometimes it's in the way of kids getting what they deserve.
Well, I ask a lot of people on this show what sector is ready for disruption, and education would be the number one answer that I receive. Speaking of dollars, what's your business model for Dream, and what are your key sources of revenue?
Yeah, it's really, you know, when we started and we were just a Little League baseball program, there was no institutional money, public or private, that would support this. But what there were is a lot of wealthy people in New York City who thought baseball was the most important thing in their life. So we'd go and we'd get a guy to give us $1,000 to sponsor a team or whatever it would be. We didn't know at the time we were building a fairly robust individual giving mm-hmm. fundraising machine, but that's what we're doing. And today we raise about $15 million a year in privately sourced money of all types, from huge New York City foundations, places like Robin Hood and Tiger and Clark foundations, but from prominent New York City corporations and many, many wealthy individuals, and even not so wealthy individuals who really believe in our cause. And I think somewhere in the ballpark of 4,000 or 5,000 donors a year mm-hmm. contribute to this number. On the other side, we do have a lot of formal public grant making, and of course the charter school funds do kick off a significant amount of funding to allow that school to grow. So today, for our $30 million budget, it's actually about half public, half private. And maintaining that balance is really important to us. We think that the public dollars do need to be subsidized to do all the things we want to do in extended day, extended year context. We think the private money also provides lots of fodder for innovation and excellence, and particularly supporting the excellence of our people, who, if we don't retain them and grow them in our organization, we really have nothing.
Yeah, some of those unrestricted dollars really can allow you to do a lot of other things. You know, I thought I saw in your strategic plan that you have a vision to become a national organization serving young people across the country. Where do you stand with that?
We've got a toe in the water. So I'd say I think actually the plan says we'll explore this idea.
That's what I'm doing.
And I think it's pretty heady stuff. I mean, I think, you know, the work that I've been talking about is ultimately extremely local and relational. At the end of the day, it is all about your coach and your teacher and mm-hmm. your mentor. That is what makes the difference. No grand plan makes the difference. It is only excellence in the relationships between adults and children and their peers. That means what you are building is, in fact, a culture of high support, a culture of opportunity, of high expectation and excellence. And those types of cultures are not easily replicated, not impossible, but not easily replicated. And I do think they are slow to grow. So a first step in this is a summer learning program we've started in Newark. We've committed to mm-hmm. 5 years of growing in that community, and our first summer last year felt really successful, but it felt like it had to be just to get to year two. And we'll see. I think philanthropically, we can figure it out. I think there's a real question about whether excellence is as scalable in other geographies as we want it to be. And you know, we struggle every day to make things as excellent as we want in our home communities. But we'll keep kicking at it.
Yeah.
We won't do it too fast. But, of course, we are always looking for leverage and impact and scale and to scale those two things first and foremost.
Well, you've already crossed state lines, so you're on your way. Let me close with this, Rich. You know, as we were discussing, there's so much frustration on the part of many Americans that we're just unable to improve our schools as much as we would like, and really as much as we need to remain competitive on the world stage. And you've been doing this work very successfully for 20-plus years. What lessons, what insights have you absorbed that, if applied broadly, would really serve our nation's schools and our nation's children well?
Now, I think there's one lesson I've learned in around the public education and the raising of our kids and over the last 20, 25 years. And unfortunately, it is this. When there's ever a choice between institutional power and what kids need in poor communities, institutional power prevails.
Mm.
We have to disrupt that cycle. We have to become committed to our children's needs above the adults' needs. And that's hard because it's not like those things are not interconnected in many ways.
Sure.
But we're shooting ourselves in the foot if we don't. Because if we don't educate our kids and not just prepare them to be the next generation of consumers, but the next generation of citizens, we're going to end up in a place where people perhaps can't distinguish between real and fake, for instance. And that's scary and dangerous and I think really kind of sad. But we've got to get committed to kids' needs, and we've got to get committed to the idea that only in embracing our diversity and the diversity of opinions and experiences in this country, from women, from men, from people of color, from immigrants, that is what America is. America is a place of inclusivity and voice and agency of all citizens. And if we don't figure out a way to leverage everything we have, we will end up in a very bad place. And clearly that is today's battle.
Mm-hmm. Well, Richard Berlin, the executive director of DREAM, I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. For those listeners who want to learn more about DREAM and your impact, what's your website and what will they find there?
Website is wearedream.org. They will find ways to volunteer, to donate, to learn great things about our work and beautiful pictures of our kids and our kids and our team busy at play and work. And most importantly, growing into amazing, amazing young adults.
Great, Rich. It was a real pleasure to have you on the program.
Thanks, Denver.
I'll be back with more of The Business of Giving right after this.
I just finished months of chemo, but I don't want to talk about months. I want to talk about years. Treatments have gotten better, so I'm hoping for good years ahead. That's thanks to research funded by the American Cancer Society. The same folks giving me free rides to treatments, insurance advice, and a place to stay during chemo. I need that stuff like you don't know. And now that you do, please give at cancer.org.
The Nature Conservancy believes in a world where nature and people can thrive together. Visit nature.org now to learn more about how you can be our partner.
Before you give to charity, go to charitynavigator.org. Charity Navigator provides free ratings of thousands of America's largest charities, helping you get the most out of your charitable dollar. Charitynavigator.org, your guide to intelligent giving.
Johnny, that's better than most. That is better than most. Better than most!
Better Than Most is a regular feature of The Business of Giving, examining the best places to work among social businesses and nonprofit organizations.
Tonight, you will visit one of the most respected and admired of all government agencies. It's the Peace Corps, started by President Kennedy back in 1961. It's an interesting organization in that most employees are limited to a maximum of 5 years of employment with the agency. That creates a distinct corporate culture, as you will learn.
The five-year rule, and people, maybe you others might disagree with me on this, but I feel like working within that tight timeline, it really motivates you to get things done quickly. We work, you know, I think really well to build consensus around new ideas, but there also is a constant motivation to keep pushing and keep striving to make things better, both for the Peace Corps volunteers that we work with and support, but also the communities that they support by that proxies.
So that's what drew me here, and I've loved working here. It's amazing. You know, you work with so many that are people that are return volunteers and that are motivated not just by their work, but a real, like, spirit of service in this agency, I think, is what drives us all to come to work every day.
The cool thing to have at your desk or in your office are cultural artifacts from around the world. For jewelry, or your scarf, it's very kind of global, and that's the kind of cool, chic thing to be wearing and to have a part of your personal space and environment. And that's fun. It's colorful and vibrant, and you combine people who are driven to do the work because they believe in the mission with an environment that is attractive and global and simultaneously highlighting some of the elements of that mission. It makes it just a really nice space to be.
One of the things that I kept hearing about government agencies and, you know, what it was like to work there as I started my job search was that you have a lot of people who seem really entrenched, really stuck in a loop. You know, we hear about the inefficiencies of the federal workforce, and that hasn't really been something that I've seen here, at least not to the degree that I was expecting. And I think that's because you constantly have fresh people cycling through, you know, with new ideas. And I think there's something really exciting about that. It makes us a pretty unique agency.
Coming here is a dream come true, and I'm impressed every day by the level of commitment that I encounter as my team moves about this building and gets to know all the various components of this bigger Peace Corps community. And so I'm really excited to have this, again, this opportunity to spend time with people in offices like Third Goal, where people help return volunteers and current volunteers communicate their experiences to the world and help the American public gain a deeper appreciation for the impact of Peace Corps here at home.
So I have a long history of Peace Corps, and I think one of the things that draws people here are the sense of family and community. It is really something to be part of this shared experience that a lot of us have had through the Peace Corps, and even those people who work here at headquarters, I think, who haven't served, they do have that same spirit of service and commitment to our goals, which is really special.
I think it's unique to the Peace Corps and separate, you know, distinct from other federal agencies in that. So the Peace Corps has a program called the Employee Volunteer Program, where staff are incentivized to go out for up to 52 hours in a given calendar year. And give back to different programs or other operating entities that do different kinds of activities to really enhance the community that we work in.
I said that I felt a spiritual impulse to live with and serve people in the developing world, and they asked me, why didn't you just find a mission group and serve in that way. And I hadn't really thought about that. And I realized that being a Peace Corps volunteer was an opportunity to meet that need that I felt, but also to serve my country and to be a representative of the United States of America abroad in a place where people may have never met an American.
I do also really appreciate the employee resource groups. I'm the president of the Women's Employee Resource Group, we at PC. It's a really great opportunity to, again, draw upon the sense of community and as well provide professional development opportunities to our colleagues.
One of the things I've found about Peace Corps is, especially with the five-year rule, there's a lot of opportunity to move into new positions and to move into new roles that you might not have a lot of experience in, but you're really valued and encouraged to move, you know, around the agency and learn different departments. And so I think in that way, Peace Corps is very different from other government agencies in that you can come in and you know, have a few different jobs during your tenure, and maybe they don't all match up with what you thought you were going to do or with your background. But because we have a lot of turnover, the opportunities at Peace Corps, especially for people just coming into the agency, are really endless.
Oh, Peace Corps has something called credit hours, where we generally staff works on a maxi flex schedule, where you know can be somewhat flexible in meeting the 80 needed hours every week. But if you work more than 80, I mean every 2 weeks, if you work more than 80 every 2 weeks, you can essentially save up to 24 hours and then cash them in whenever you want, which for me, coming from nonprofit, where I would regularly work 60, 70 hour weeks, not 2 weeks, weeks, that just blew my mind.
One thing that I saw really up close while I was there was just how much collaboration they had with other posts in the region and even outside of their region who were working on similar projects. And I think, you know, that really is the essence of the Peace Corps mission, right? Like sharing culture, exchanging ideas, because there is no one answer to, you know, solving the development challenges that exist in the world.
I want to thank all those who participated in this segment. Tom Garrity, Clarissa Hughes, Clayton Kennedy, Dominic Abreu, Matt Sheehy, and Rachel Boyda. To hear this again, read the transcript, and see pictures of the participants and the offices of the Peace Corps, just come visit denver-frederick.com. And that is this week's show. Next week, you will hear from David Wish, the CEO and founder of Little Kids Rock, an organization that transforms lives through music in our schools. Thanks for listening. Have a great week, and I hope you'll return next Sunday evening for The Business of Giving.
The preceding program is paid for by the friends and partners of The Business of Giving.
3-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.